The Brexit economy is languishing in stagnation and decline. The UK is set to be one of the worst performing economies in the world this year, but you wouldn't know it from the rhetoric of the government and their apparently endless appetite for striking new trade deals. As the UK joins CPTPP, a free trade bloc on the other side of the world, today we take a closer look at who exactly is benefiting from the government's trade diplomacy.
Well, the UK has announced it is joining the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Britain's agriculture lobby has been quite vocal about the government perhaps granting too much access to overseas farmers at the expense of Britain's own.
This ultimately opens the floodgates to allow substandard products onto our shelves.
A broken economic model has sacrificed people of the global south to extract wealth, both of people and of natural resources.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Luke Cooper. Our guest on today's show is Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now. Nick's been campaigning against dodgy corporate trade deals for decades. Today, he talks us through the latest global Britain Brexit car crash and how the UK has signed up to a trade agreement that Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have all loudly condemned. Welcome back to the Another Europe podcast. You are, well, I know I speak for only for myself, but you're definitely my favourite guest. How are you and what have you been up to?
I bet you say that to everybody.
I really do.
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right, thanks. I've been writing a book, actually.
Oh, cheeky plug.
You might be interested in something in the future. Cheeky plug, it's not out yet, but yeah, all about the pharmaceutical industry and what it says about the modern economy. So, which is a little bit related to trade deals, but not entirely.
Oh, it sounds like Nick just pitched to come back on the podcast at a later occasion. I mean, Nick, I wouldn't say you're my favourite guest, but you're not my least favourite either.
Oh, wow.
it's just tough when there's Gary Stevenson out there, though, isn't it? I'd say you're in my top three.
I want to just refine my point, Luke, which is that Gary Stevenson is awesome, but I think because of that Brexit podcast we did, when we had like quite a personal conversation about how much we bitterly regretted our own actions and which of them we regretted the most, I kind of felt like we got somewhere really important.
Oh, that was a good podcast, actually. That was a very popular podcast, too. So we've just done two plugs in the space of 2 minutes, one for the Another Europe archive and one for Nick's forthcoming book. So this is a fantastic start. So let's start with the acronyms, Nick. What is CPTPP?
It stands for the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So initially, this was the deal that was just called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where the US was involved from Obama's days, and it became utterly, utterly toxic in the United States for reasons we can go into. But as a result, the US pulled out and Canada tried to reinvent it. I mean, they didn't really change very much at all. A few bits got dropped, but they added this comprehensive and progressive at the beginning, which sounded nice. We are calling it just the Pacific Trade Deal because it's essentially a bunch of countries that surround the Pacific, and particularly a bunch of countries also that surround China, which in some ways was part of the point of it in the first place.
And this isn't the first deal that the UK has signed, has it? It's been very, very busy post-Brexit, basically trying with seemingly ever greater desperation to demonstrate that Brexit was worthwhile because we can sign all these trade deals.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that was one thing they continually said through the campaign, wasn't it? Like, this was one of the big Brexit dividends, that all of a sudden we could sign our own trade deals. Now, actually, most of the deals they've signed are just deals that the EU already had. They've kind of reinterpreted them and changed the name within the deal, and they've signed a few dozen like that. They've then signed some of their own deals, but really not very many compared to what they said they were going to do, but particularly ones with Australia and New Zealand, which are also part of the Pacific Trade Deal. But this is the biggest. This is the biggest they've signed up to because it includes so many different countries.
I mean, often when I see the headlines, my main worry is that the numbers seem so piffling, so kind of trifling, you know, kind of 0.8 5% boost to trade set against the massive losses suffered from the kind of post-Brexit landscape. But you're, I mean, that's not, I've got my eye on the wrong thing, right?
Well, I know, I think you're right in some ways. I mean, it would add, it's not even 0.8, it's 0.08% to the economy over about 10 years. So it's really tiny. But yeah, some of the worrying, like nonetheless, it is going to do some stuff that I think we should be worried about, which of course makes you ask, begs the question, why are they doing it? Like, what's their game? And I think there's two answers to that. One is, I think, you know, as Luke says, there's a kind of desperation just to prove that this has all worked. And, you know, particularly this was one of Liz Truss's favourite games, wasn't it? Just sign a deal, whatever's in it, it makes us look great. And, you know, it clearly went down very well with the Tory membership. And, you know, the amount of good or bad it did seemed a bit irrelevant, really. I think there's a deeper reason for some of this stuff, which I think is that, you know, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but part of the rationale for Brexit was fundamentally reorienting the British economy away from European standards and regulations and towards both the United States on the one hand and the Pacific on the other. And that's where some of the more things that we might be more worried about come in. But particularly for the Brexiteers, I mean, they held this up as, well, this gets us one step further away from the EU. And that's great, because if a future government ever comes in and thinks about getting closer to the EU, this is one more little obstacle in their path.
And so from your perspective, what are the big ticket items in this deal that are problematic?
So I would say three things probably. The first is very, very specific. And that is, in order to get this deal, it seems that Malaysia has been able to push back. I mean, they've been pushing back for years now on the European tariffs that apply to palm oil. European tariffs on palm oil are basically supposed to slow down deforestation in Malaysia, because the palm oil industry is intimately connected with deforestation in that country. So the European Union said, as part of its climate commitments, we need to stop that. So we're going to make it harder to import palm oil. Britain and you know, for animal lovers, well, all of us really, you know, one of the things that the deforestation affects hugely is populations of orangutan in Malaysia. So Britain has scrapped that under Malaysian pressure. Trade Secretary was on the TV just saying, well, you know, too bad, isn't it? You know, you've got to make compromises when you sign trade deals. So that's a concern. But actually, that's more symbolic of a more general concern. And we've talked about this before, but modern trade deals by and large are not about reducing tariffs, particularly between rich countries. They are about setting standards. Could be food standards, could be standards that apply to industry. And at the moment, as we know, Britain still has the precautionary principle embedded in the way that it regulates things like food standards. So that's, you know, if there's any doubt, if we're worried that this is going to be detrimental, the onus is supposedly on industry to prove something safe before it goes on the market. And most other places in the world don't have that. The US doesn't have it, but most of the Pacific countries don't have it either. So there's a real concern here that over time, because modern trade deals tend to include kind of regulatory alignment and removing standards where they can't actually be proved to be harmful, that essentially it's the thin end of the wedge. It is the way that eventually hormone treated beef and all of the other things that we were worried about in the US trade deal get agreed and enter into force. So we're really worried about that. It's not something that's going to happen immediately, but it is something we know countries are going to use over time. You know, it essentially gives big business lobbyists ever more power over our regulations and standards, and power that's often exercised in back rooms. So that's a real concern. And the third concern is this awful corporate court system, which I have talked about endlessly, which allows foreign corporations to sue foreign governments for doing pretty much nowadays anything they don't like. And it's become a major problem in terms of governments being able to pass climate legislation, take the climate action we know is so necessary, because again and again and again, corporations are using this corporate court system to sue governments because they say, well, you're passing climate action policies, that affects my bottom line, it affects my profits over the next 20 years, you owe me compensation for that. And so it's becoming a real impediment to the kind of government action that we need and are calling for at the moment.
We put this in the introduction. It was a great first line to a piece you wrote for The Guardian as well, that Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, and Hillary Clinton, so the far right, the neoliberal center, and the radical left, respectively, all really dislike this trade deal in the US. It became toxic in American politics. And I suppose there's an interesting contrast there, isn't there, in terms of the trajectories of right-wing politics in the UK compared to right-wing politics in the US, that the US increasingly has a kind of national consensus around this protection, more protectionist economic policies in general, and a dislike for the deindustrializing impacts of these global corporate trade deals. And in the UK, you know, many people would look at Brexit and Trump, and indeed another Europe have made this argument, you know, saying Brexit is the Trumpist franchise. But in economic policy, it hasn't gone in the same direction. There's still this attachment to this neoliberal internationalism, global free trade, these swashbuckling corporate, you know, imaginaries, basically. So could you tell us a bit about that? You know, why do you think it became so toxic in the United States?
It's a good question why it's happened quite so radically. I mean, certainly the American public became really sick of what I would call hyper-globalization. Now, you know, free trade is an interesting concept. In Britain, we have this kind of 19th century idea of free trade, that it's all about everybody having as low a tariff as possible. And, you know, that's a small part of it. But as I say, I think hyper-globalization, modern trade deals go way beyond that. I mean, they are not just about having low tariffs on goods. They are about the regulatory cooperation I've talked about, which too often becomes a race to the bottom. But they're about all sorts of other things, like intellectual property standards. I mean, when it comes down to it, they're essentially about giving capital power and rights far beyond the power and rights of ordinary people. And so, you know, unsurprisingly, that means capital will go to produce wherever it's cheapest and there are lowest regulations. So America has seen, you know, huge amounts of jobs lost in offshoring. And that's a particularly big issue in American politics, you know, the Rust Belt and what happened to those jobs and our leaders just kind of allowing big corporations to do what they want in the world, regardless of how much good it does to the average American. That became a massive, massive issue. And so, yeah, you've seen a wave both on the right and the left there. And indeed, it's playing a major role in Biden's policy. You know, Biden was once upon a time a great supporter of corporate trade deals. You know, he hasn't done one and he's not going to do one. He's not interested. He's recognized that this moment requires a moving away from this hyper-globalization towards more resilient and sustainable economies. He's realized that ordinary American workers need to get something out of the way their economy works. And I just think we fundamentally haven't done that in this country for many reasons. One of the reasons I suspect is that the leaders of the Brexit movement, you know, from Nigel Farage through to Rishi Sunak, are really committed to a kind of free market vision of the world. I mean, their commitment to the right and rules of capital are in many ways greater than the kind of populists on the right in the United States and in other parts of Europe and in other parts of the world, I should say. They just haven't got it. And so that means that, and it's interesting because I actually think a big part of why some people, you know, a reasonable part of this country did vote for Brexit and became, you know, very, very committed to leaving the European Union was actually the same sense of being really sick of hyper-globalization and the way it's removed, you know, a feeling of control over our lives and our economy and our society. I feel that was driving people, but it was never, you know, it was never reflected really in the politics of the leaders of the Brexit campaign. And we've talked about that before, haven't we? This idea that they had of creating this kind of Singapore on Thames was in some ways completely at odds with what many of the supporters of leaving the European Union actually wanted.
Can I just throw in two thoughts and tell me if they're wrong or right? The first is that kind of classically, the kind of Ha-Joon Chang version of free trade and what it means is that the winners are really into free trade and the losers are really not into it. You know, it's like when you're in a developing economy, you need you need to protect your industries. And when you're in a developed economy, you don't. You need to exploit other people's. And sort of what we're seeing in the US is a recognition of their de-developing status in a way that the UK just won't recognise in its political discourse. You know, they're recognizing their own decline with their new protectionist rhetoric.
I think it's a really interesting and complicated question, actually, that to some degree, yes. I think the thing is, when your free trade is based upon you being industrially superior to others, there is probably something your own workforce gains from that, right? There definitely was in Britain, where free trade policy actually went hand in hand with our imperial policy. You know, we were just industrially superior to most countries in the world, maybe excepting Germany, which is why, you know, the 20th century were characterized by wars between Britain and Germany. But yeah, there is something in that. But I think one of the problems is capitalism and how people derive value from the market has really changed quite fundamentally in the last 40 years. And although that, you know, what you're saying is part of it, at the same time, you know, corporations today tend to derive way more value from their intellectual property, for example, their intangible assets, their brands, and all of these things are highly protected under the international trade system. I mean, it's why I don't really use trade terms like protectionist, because in some ways, you know, our international economy is very protective. It's just protective of the wrong interests. And those things have become highly protected, and American corporations have done extremely well out of that, extremely well. The problem is that's become almost disconnected from the economy that those corporations are based in. And I think that's really extreme in America, and partly because, of course, the United States has such poor welfare systems, you know, such poor social support systems that people really feel it in a way that they feel it, it's bad here, but it's not as bad. So I think that's, you know, that's one thing. But I just think the whole economy has so fundamentally shifted, and that means we've got to change the way we think about trade deals too. So yes, American workers have done very badly, and I think that is partly due to shifts in the American economy, but it's also due to shifts in the way that the capital operates.
So I had one more question about the relative perceptions of industrial decline between the US and the UK, because I personally think the reason they took to Trump in the way they did was because they've always conceived the loss of those manufacturing jobs in terms of who took them. Whereas in the UK, we've always conceived the loss of our manufacturing and mining jobs in terms of the insufficiency of government response in, you know, with the social safety net, with retraining, with creating new jobs, and never really looked at what happened to those sectors that got decimated in the UK, what other country kind of picked them up, where we were getting the stuff that we no longer produced. And I just don't know, in terms of where a kind of galvanized and creative political response comes from, i.e. a political response which isn't, you know, a Trumpist protectionism, but nor is it a kind of Brexity random lashing out at Westminster. How do you kind of marshal those declines in a better way?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because I think Nick's point about, like, what do you mean by who is being protected is the really, like, key one, isn't it? Because, of course, the global financial system is obsessed with what the, you know, financial discourse is called de-risking. So, you know, basically trying to find more and more innovative ways to reduce the risks that capital faces when it invests. And you've got really good reason to try and do that in the current global economy, because it's not so easy to make money. So you want, and there's loads of crises around, there's loads of instability, there's loads of risks. So, you know, the more that you can attune regulation to your interests, and the more support from the state that you can find, you know, in the form of subsidies and other things, the better to secure your profit lines. But then there's this other question that I think we often talk around a lot, because, you know, the politics and the economics don't map onto each other very clearly. So if you look at a figure like Donald Trump, I mean, yes, in his 2016 election campaign, you know, as we've discussed on this podcast before, he went, you know, really strongly along this line of Bernie Sanders-esque line, almost, that deindustrialization of the United States has destroyed the American dream and I will make America great again. But then on the other hand, if you look at some of his biggest supporters, from people in the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives to political outsiders and capitalists like Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal, they don't believe in any form of social security whatsoever. They're about as minimalist when it comes to the social protection of the state as you can imagine. So what that Freedom Caucus line is increasingly kind of agreeing on is that we need that the current global regulatory regime for American capital doesn't effectively suit American capital's interests. So we're going to go hard on protecting American capital in relation to China, in relation to the emerging markets. But then at home, well, we're going to do nothing to protect the American worker.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And you know, there's a degree to which they're right. American capital is threatened by Chinese capital in a way, you know, that we haven't seen for a very long time. I was looking at the Fortune 500 index recently, and there are more Chinese multinational corporations in the top 500 corporations in the world now than there are American corporations. I mean, it's big. It's a huge shift globally. And so you're right. American capital is also concerned about that. And for us, how do we navigate that, right? So I think coming back to Zoe's question, I mean, I think that that is what Biden's kind of trying to do. I mean, to my amazement, really, I mean, I'm quite impressed by some of his policies. And in the way that Trump for me represented a kind of, yeah, protectionist, chaotic form of deglobalization, I think Biden represents, you know, a more managed form of deglobalization, which is a bit, you know, which is not simply, you know, the bully gets their way. And what that means in practice is a form of economy where we don't simply say we will buy wherever it's cheapest because that's good for the consumer. The consumer will get cheap goods out of that. I mean, that's what we've all been told, right, for 40 years now, and it's worked for quite a long time. Oh, prices are going down, so that's a good thing, and you get more choice, so that's a good thing. Like, what else could you want? And I think, yeah, in America, that and to here to some degree, that's come up against the hard reality of not much good is it if I don't have a decent job. And I think what Biden's administration is now doing is saying, look, the goal here should not be simply the cheapest good, you know, produced in the cheapest way possible. The goal has got to be resilience and sustainability in our own economy. And you don't do that simply by putting up tariffs on everything. I mean, that was Trump's way, and that's been traditionally, you know, a lot of right-wing populists have used tariffs in that way. I'm personally not really in favor, particularly of advanced countries using tariffs in that way. I mean, here and there you might want to do it, but by and large, I think you do it by restructuring your own economy and restructuring your own economy towards the interests of ordinary people. And it's fascinating to me to look at some of look at Biden's State of the Union speeches. And not all of it, but elements of them, you wouldn't have been surprised to hear John McDonnell, Jeremy Corbyn say in their Labour Party conference speeches. You know, they are massive attacks on monopoly capitalism, essentially, and how it's ripping off ordinary Americans. And I think that it's that restructuring in, like, domestically, that will begin to get us out of this. Now, the follow-on question to that is, what does a global economy, what does an international economy based on those kind of policies look like? And I think that's where almost no work's been done. And I guess it kind of falls to groups like mine to begin thinking that through.
We're at risk of having an optimistic conversation. So in order to move firmly back to pessimism, let's start talking about Britain. It looks quite likely that the Tories are going to lose the next election. So Nick, the Labour Party is going to presumably be in government in one form or another, whether it's a minority government, whether it's a coalition or what have you. Are they going to get us out of these corporate trade deals or not?
Well, the response so far is not particularly hopeful, in that the shadow trade secretary, you know, continually says, we're not going to renegotiate any of this stuff. And in terms of, you know, the really big one, the trade deal with the US that we were particularly frightened about, you know, their main message is, why haven't you done it quicker, to the government? So there, and you know, of course, across the piece, I mean, we've just been through, you know, the most awful few days and weeks in terms of seeing how Labour's going to run its election campaign. And I think all of us are feeling, you know, somewhat disillusioned, to put it very, very lightly, about that. There is one aspect of what Labour has said and what Starmer said that gives me a bit of hope, and that is to begin talking about industrial strategy again. And they have been pretty shocked, to be honest, by some of what Biden's done, particularly this Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, as it's called, massive state subsidies and government intervention and planning across the economy. And I think they have begun to realise, particularly out of the EU, this is all going to be more difficult for Britain to do, but we're going to have to do it. You know, we are going to have to seriously start thinking of how we begin to move away from hyper-globalisation, because the other big players in the world are doing it. And they have begun to think about that, certainly in terms of green industrial strategy. Some of the stuff Ed Miliband's doing is quite interesting. However, does it at the moment add up to anything like what we need? No, it doesn't. And I think one of the main problems for me is they are absolutely terrified of upsetting any aspect of the British business community, you know, including the financial sector. And that's worrying, because when you start talking about subsidies, when you start talking about planning and intervention, and you don't actually restructure the relations between capital and labour in this country, essentially what you end up with is massive corporate welfare and kind of public-private partnerships where power is all in the hands of the private sector. If we are offering support to an intervention in the economy, support to industry and so on, there's got to be a quid pro quo there. And that is that we need the British economy and British business to operate in a fundamentally different way. And Labour are just absolutely terrified to say that.
It's frustrating, because I feel that there would be an open door on these questions in both the politics and the economics. So in relation to the economics, the open door is that this is just the direction the world is kind of moving in, for the reasons that we've discussed. And also, you know, in terms of the comparison that with the United States and the UK, I mean, it's obviously worth bearing in mind that the UK has taken deindustrialization radically further over the last 40 years than has happened in the United States. And, you know, in many places that 40 years ago would have been at the centre of British industry are now, you know, at most might have some warehouses for distribution centres in the service economy, but and don't really produce anything of any note at all. So, you know, your starting point really for like any kind of progressive agenda would be, you know, can we actually grow and build and expand the UK manufacturing and industrial economy in the industries of the future?
I'm not standing up for the Labour Party, and I will ask you both in a second where you are on that forthcoming victory. But just to be fair, right, the Green New Deal is probably as much money as any government could have committed to exactly the kind of green infrastructure investment that you're talking about and reskilling that you're talking about. And okay, there is kind of meat to go on the bones. We don't know how much of it would be committed to reskilling, to kind of disseminating the industries across the country, to which is effectively its own kind of leveling up, and to becoming a world leader, although I have to say that ship has sailed on both solar and windmills now. You know, in terms of, if you look at kind of China and Denmark, we're not going to become a world leader, but we might well become a world player. The thing that I'm kind of worried about is not that there's no thinking in the Labour Party about what a new industrial strategy would look like. It's more that what you were saying earlier, Nick, about the kind of terror. They're in this kind of petrification about being seen as an enemy of any kind of inverted commas wealth creator, and that does seem to create a stasis and a cowardice that makes me really unwilling to believe even the pledges they've made.
Completely. I mean, I agree. Look, I agree with you. I completely agree with you, Zoe. As I say, I think it's the it's the best thing they've committed to, the Green New Deal stuff, and I don't think it's insignificant. I think it's very significant. But the problem is, I think they're limited by their own caution, and that worries me, because if they're not prepared to say it now, do we really think they're going to be more likely to say it after the election? You know, history would suggest that's not really what happens. And you're right. I mean, the wealth, you know, it goes to a really extreme example where there's a financial deregulation bill going through Parliament at the moment. I mean, they're doing almost nothing to critique that. This is talking about stripping away some of the rules that were brought in after 2008 to try to create a little bit more security and safety in the economy. And it's not radical stuff, you know, it's basic stuff. You know, we've been campaigning on the commodity speculation stuff that they're preparing to strip away the rules on. And Labour's just, you know, there's almost nothing. They're so scared. And if you're not even prepared to countenance the regulation of the most footloose bit of the economy, the most unstable bit of the economy, you know, that bit of regulation you actually need to create business certainty and so on, that just does not bode well for them being able to create the kind of economy that we desperately need. And look, as a result of Brexit in the short term, and as a result of many other factors in the long term, we are in real crisis in this country. And it's going to take more than, you know, a good policy here and a good policy there. It needs a transformative economic program that I don't think they've got at the moment. And my concern is, if they do not have a program that adds up in office, I mean, by the amount of money and intervention Biden has committed to, and even that, you know, his election is on a knife edge if the polls are to be believed. So, you know, you've really, really got to give it something at the moment if you hope that it's going to work with a population which is, you know, incredibly unstable and you know, massive inequality. It takes so much, and I just don't think that program is there at the moment across the board. And if it's not there, my worry is, you know, where do people turn next? Because if it doesn't work, you know, you're potentially looking at one term in office, and then what happens? Where do people look for hope then?
Although I would just say, though, in the $28 billion a year on Green New Deal is in per capita terms bigger than what Biden is doing with the Inflation Reduction Act. And of course, it's not a direct comparison because, you know, in the US, the states are also big fiscal players when it comes to energy and everything. But, you know, worth keeping in mind, it does stand the test of the comparative examples internationally if they deliver it. And of course, that brings us back to the willingness to tackle vested interests, because if they're being so cautious and cautious at best when they're not in government, it doesn't really bode well for when they actually are in government.
Yeah, totally agree. And look, up to this point, I've been willing to, you know, I think there is something there, so I've been willing to, you know, really try and, you know, push towards the good and say, yeah, great, let's go a bit further. I think I have had my enthusiasm a little bit dampened in recent weeks, just because, you know, on the law and order stuff, we're going way off topic now, but just on the drug reform stuff, it just seems to me, this is not hard stuff. So, you know, if they're not prepared to do just a little bit more, which there's every sign is actually electorally popular on issues like that, just makes you despair a bit, doesn't it?
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. Members of Another Europe get access to extra material as a benefit of membership. In this pod's extra time, we look at what the concept of monopoly capitalism tells us about a world in crisis. To join Another Europe is possible, go to anotheureupe.org/join.